house love is begging door to door. Live from inside the Samsung mobile phone headquarters design office, where we come up with all original ideas, it's the SideQuest episode 414, the second take. Spare some change. I am Dally Domofsky. Joining me as usual is Steven Strum.
You know, Dally, the best part about that Samsung joke is it'll be really timely when this post goes up 3 hours or 3 days later.
More like 3 weeks later. Considering
3 months.
Our last episode of 414 never got uploaded. So, and we also have Tyler Culp on the show today. How's it going, Tyler?
Pretty good.
It's awesome to have you on the show.
Yeah, finally.
You've been on SideQuesting for almost a year, and you're just now getting on the show.
Yeah, you're right. It has been like almost a year, huh?
Yeah, you just now can afford a some type of microphone thanks to all the pay that we've given you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really all fantastic.
Well, yeah, he was in every episode previous to this since he's been on the website. It's just you couldn't hear him because he was just shouting over like 200-mile distances.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that cup didn't reach.
Yeah, it's there's some electrical storms in Seattle that hurt the string between the two cups that we had focused. Well, welcome to the show, Tyler. It's good to have a fresh voice on. Last time we had Ryan Franklin, another one of our new writers, and
fun fact about Ryan: could not hang with this crew.
Could not hang. Yeah, fun fact, Ryan, you suck. You suck balls.
We put him back in the. Don't worry, listeners. We heard your pleas. We put him back in the chimney, where he will never harm another child again.
I think there's like a zero Ryan limit on the podcast these days, isn't there? So we had Ryan Franklin on. We haven't had Ryan Gann on in damn near a year.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
No,
I like that.
It's been longer than a year because I've been working for you guys for longer than a year, and I've never been on a podcast with Ryan on it.
Oh yeah, you haven't. Wow. You haven't, really? Well, yeah. that just shocked me for a second there. I just gained hit puberty with my voice, but wow, we'll have to remedy that. Ryan's actually an excellent podcaster, but he never likes the podcast anymore for some reason. Anyways, we got a fantastic show planned for you guys today. We're gonna try to keep this to an hour. Which we always say, it ends up going for like four. In the meantime, let's kick things off. So Tyler, you're new to the show. What have you been playing?
I just tried Gravity Bone. Did you guys ever play that when it came out?
No.
Like, I think
what
2009.
Is this?
2009.
What is
Gravity Bone? Yeah, it's my favorite Vita game. I've talked about it on this podcast. You're late.
Yeah. No, actually, Gravity Bone is like I guess it's an indie game by Blendo Games. It's a guy named Brendan.
Sounds like an indie company.
Yeah. And it's a really weird game. It's free. It's only like 15 minutes long too. And it's like a linear first person, it's not a shooter. It's first person, like short story. I guess that would be the best way to describe it. It's just like this weird kind of, it's got this like little story that, it's hard to explain because it's something that, like, if you explain a little bit of it, you kind of give away the whole point of it because, like I said, it's only like 15 minutes long. But it has like a little bit of like platforming in it, all done obviously in the first person perspective. And it has, you start out with you're in like a party, and they tell you like where to go, and basically from there you follow these directions on this little piece of paper. And you just do these different tasks, and these tasks take you along this kind of ride where eventually, by the end of it, you still have no clue what's going on. That was a really interesting little game, especially since it's free. But there's a sequel to it that I actually did just buy. It was like $5 compared to the first one. I thought, like, I don't think I'd pay any money for this because it's so short and so confusing that when I actually went and bought the second one, it's called 30 Flights of Loving. I was kind of wondering, like, hey, maybe it'll be a lot longer of a game, or maybe at least double the length, but it's actually shorter, I think. It's like 13 minutes instead of the 15.
Well, Tyler can't keep his vocals going for that long anymore. He's gotten old, man.
Yeah.
Like, 30 Flights of Loving is my favorite Steven Tyler solo project song, though. Man, what pipes on that man. What talent, what courage.
What the hell are you talking about?
30 Flights of Lovin', you cannot tell me 30 Flights of Lovin' does not sound like a
song. Yeah, it does. I don't even know what it means still. By the end of that game, I don't even know. So, and it's supposed to be a sequel, but like there's a developer commentary that you play through, where I played through after I finished it the first time, and the guy said it was like a prototype of Gravity Bone before he made it. So I still have no clue what the connection really is, other than maybe you're the same guy, but they don't ever show you. So it's really confusing. But yeah, it's similar in the same way as the first one, is you just follow directions, and then eventually you're doing these wacky things of like, you know, you're carrying a guy bleeding out in like a cart around an airplane, or around an airport, and you're just like, I don't know, you're just finishing more objectives basically. But the really interesting thing about it is mostly that like it's kind of these disjointed like memories that you're doing. So it's all like you'll be running through the airport, and then all of a sudden it'll just flash to like another memory, and then you're just like running through another area that's just like kind of building a story of what little there is. And eventually, like it's almost like a love story a little bit. The second one has a little more coherence in like the story, and actually makes a little bit more sense. But even then, I don't even know what it has to do with the first one, and I don't even know what I really did. But yeah, it's like $5. I'm not really sure if it's worth the $5, because it seems like it's such a short experience that it's, I don't know if it's worth your time spending that much money for, I don't know, something very small. But if it ever goes down on Steam, I would recommend it. The commentary on it, though, the developer commentary, is actually kind of interesting. The guy really shows a lot of the stuff. Like, he went through and like did kind of like a montage of him like modeling each of the little special items in the game that you see. And I thought it was really interesting. Like, just a little – I think most developer commentaries are pretty interesting. But this one, he was kind of – he really explained a lot of like the kind of – for what a game that doesn't really make much sense, the stuff that he says it really adds to like that experience. I think maybe making it worth the $5, but it's kind of one of the things you almost need to play through, because it doesn't make much sense the rest of it. But I guess one thing with the second one too is that it has a little bit more ambition with like maybe the design of like the environments, because the first one's very, very linear, and it's not very like, you're not going through big areas, and you aren't really in the second one either. But it seems like he kind of takes the direction of it being where it's a really colorful game, and then he takes it kind of in different directions in the sequel. So
it also looks like Minecraft.
Yeah, I was gonna say the same thing. It has a little bit of that Minecraft look to it. It's like
I forget what engine it runs on. It's like on the Unreal Engine, not the Unreal Engine. I don't remember, but yeah, it was like, I guess it started out as a mod. But yeah,
some real bad texture pop in this game full of giant polygons, like big block people.
I'm not sure. I don't think it's Unreal Engine. I think I got that wrong. I forget what engine it is, but
it's probably Unity. Yeah, it's what everything else is.
Yeah, I don't think it's Unity. But yeah, it's what's really weird.
I think it's Unreal Engine. Until you say that it's something else, in which case I think it's that. Dally, why don't you just make up some bullshit? Like this runs in the Infinity Engine.
It runs in the Infinity Engine, yeah. It's the same engine that powers the new Madden 13.
Oh, no, it's not that Infinity Engine. It's the Infinity Engine that powered Baldur's Gate. This is all nice. Isometric, and you didn't even know.
Fun fact, if you do a search for 30 Flights of Loving in Google Images, you get a picture of Jeff Goldblum's teeth.
That's the original. Now, are we talking... Which movie version of Jeff Goldblum are we talking? Or are we talking Law & Order here?
It's like... Does that make a difference? Tonight Show. Looks like he's got a Tonight Show appearance.
I was hoping for The Fly.
Yeah,
they're really interesting games because they're so small, but the intent is really...
I love Tyler just fucking has realized, oh, this is what this show is. And just gone on, completely ignoring everything we're saying.
I thought he was going to reply back with...
I was trying to figure out what engine it is, because I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Unreal.
Source? Could it be Source?
No.
It's Minecraft Engine.
It's really really interesting podcasting here.
The sound of you Googling.
Quake 2. It's Quake 2 Engine.
Bullshit.
I don't know why I didn't know that. Yeah, the first one was. I don't know about 30 Flights of Love, but...
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's almost as good as if it had actually been done in the original Infinity Engine. Man, I want to play... Do you guys want Planescape Torment 2? Because I want Planescape Torment 2. Somebody was talking about that recently this week. Somebody was talking about somebody from like BioWare or some company, some developer was talking about how like their top like things that they would want in a remake or a sequel to Planescape Torment. Do you guys remember Planescape Torment at all? I mean, you guys, clearly you guys don't play PC games because you're intellectual midgets, but you know.
No, I never played the first one, no.
It was cool. It's you, like, you were an immortal guy who woke up every time he died, and he had like a tattoo on his chest that told him that he was immortal and he would lose his memory, and you had a talking skull that floated around and helped you, and it could insult people so hard that it did damage to them. I really want a sequel to that game.
It's like an isometric view, right? Is that the one with the kind of the overhead isometric view?
Yeah, it was Infinity, and so it was like Baldur's Gate, Baldur's Gate 2. It was a Dungeons and Dragons based, like, Planescape is a module of Dungeons and Dragons. And this is just like a story in that universe back when they were making, like...
Isn't everything these days basically a module of Dungeons & Dragons, like, in some way or another? I mean, I'm sure if there's some big family tree out there that we could put together that starts off with, like, Dungeons & Dragons at the very top, and at the bottom left-hand corner is, like, Gears of War 3, and the bottom right is, like, FIFA 11 or something.
No, because, like, before...
They're all Dungeons within Dragons.
Well, Dungeons... Yeah, they follow the same timeline.
Yeah.
You just got to get the prequel. You got to get the Shin Megami Tensei Devil Summoner 2, and that's when the alternate universe is split off. Dungeons and Dragons isn't the seed here, because that's just all based on like Lord of the Rings type shit. And Lord of the Rings is all, if you trace that far back enough, you can probably get all the way back to Beowulf, and who knows where Beowulf came from. That's, I mean, you trace it back to the real monsters that the government has locked up in Area 51. That we all knew about thousands of years ago, but our memories were erased because it's in the water supply, man.
Read my
Tumblr, man. It's all there. It's all on the Tumblr.
We all saw Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, that's a good movie. That's a very
excellent.
Good movie.
Well, I'm glad you're the one checking that out. No, I'm just kidding. did you pick it up on Steam?
Wait, 30 Flights of Loving?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was on Steam. You can get it on the website, too.
Yeah. Can
you get it on Desura?
No.
Really?
You know, one thing that I find really interesting is, I mean, obviously there's been the huge explosion in kind of indie development over the last several years, but I mean, really these last couple of years, especially with some of the things that have been going on at PAX, which you're going to be going to next week, and you know, a lot of the other initiatives online and you know, like the Humble Bundle and so on. I mean, indie gaming has just exploded to the point where I find indie gaming almost so much more interesting than the kind of mainstream big developer stuff these days.
Well, I mean, you look at the releases for this year, for 2012, and like the best games that have come out this year have all been like $12, $15 downloadable games, and most of them done by really small developers. Yep. Like Dustin Elysian Tale is one dude programming that whole thing. You know, Popo and Yo is just a couple people, like these great, interesting games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no, I mean, we'll get to these later, but like, I don't want to say shit about Darksiders 2 or anything, but like, I've just been blown away by things like Sound Shapes and shit this year.
Sure.
And the retail releases have just not been keeping up. I mean, granted, we're not at a point yet where retail releases are usually at their fever pitch. You know, we're like maybe a month out of that with Madden 13 coming out here soon. But yeah, it's been great. Like, it's been super weird to see that kind of shift. To like,
yeah, it has.
Right, like that's the B tier of games, right? Like that's where that economy went. Like back in the day, you didn't have, like, everything wasn't a AAA retail title. Now everything is a AAA retail title. But back in the day, it was like you would have a game like Shadow of the Colossus at the time. You know, was not like a Halo. You know, Halo 2 were these massive giant things. You know, a new Final Fantasy was a massive giant thing. Then you would have something like, I don't know, like a Star Ocean, or I'm trying to think of better examples than that, but or even like the Shin Megami Tensei game, stuff like that. Like these things that weren't huge blockbusters, but were games that everybody, sure, you know, that a large enough audience bought, sure, to support that kind of economy. And that kind of went away at the beginning of this console cycle. Like, if you never find games anymore that we are much closer to the industry, but I almost never find games that I've never heard of before anymore, because everything is blown out to such a huge proportion. So it's like, I don't feel like I'm going to go back, you know, 3 years from now and realize, oh, here's this great PlayStation 3 game that I never even heard of back in the day, because they make so many, because there was just so many games coming out that, you know, and the audience was there to support it. But now that's the downloadable market. That's the indies on Steam and the XBLA games and stuff like that. That's, those games still exist, except they're now they're only like $15, and they, you can just stream them right to your desktop and you, or your Xbox or whatever. And you can find, and if you want to find them, there's like a storefront that just has all of them, all there waiting for you. And that's a really great development, in my opinion, especially as the quality has jumped up so high, especially in these last like 2-3 years.
And it has been like the quality has been just fantastic in indie game development.
Well, in the past few years too, with just the big games, they've all been like sequels, so we kind of know what we're getting. So when we're getting these interesting games, I mean, Spec Ops is really interesting this year, but obviously it wasn't an amazing game, but it had something going for it, a little bit more different than what we've been getting.
Yeah. Spec Ops is an interesting case because I'm interested in everything about Spec Ops except for the video game part of Spec Ops.
Yeah.
So I'll probably wait before I get back on that train. But yeah, that's another good example of that like B-tier game that you just don't really see anymore. Like, remember when PlayStation 2 was at its heyday and like there was 18 games coming out every week just because there was 10 million PlayStation 2s everywhere?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of happened again with Steam, you know, and XBLA and XBLA, and it's which is actually like, anybody else been really underwhelmed by XBLA's offering this year, especially for the summer?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, the summer arcade was disappointing.
Like the last two were good games, right? Like Hybrid and Dust were the winners, right?
Yeah, I think the other ones were. I think they weren't like terrible, but they weren't to the standards of previous. Well,
what were the other ones? It was Deadlight.
Tony Hawk.
What was the Kinect game?
Oh, yeah, Tony Hawk. Skater HD.
Wreck-A-Tier.
Yeah. I think it says something about the overall quality of the games is that we couldn't even remember their names right off the top of our heads.
Yeah.
But yeah, I need to try out Dust. Hybrid doesn't really interest me that much just because I know it's...
It was a lot of fun at E3, Dust. It's definitely... really brought back memories of like Odin Sphere and Muramasa, the Demon Blade.
Vanillaware type stuff?
Vanillaware stuff, yeah. Just really good, really kind of cool, classic, side scrolling, artistic, fighting, you know, magic stuff. So.
Now, I know there's been like a big stink going on about that game because of the furries, right? Like the everything is designed to look like a furry or whatever. And now that bothers me. The art style of the characters in the game, but not because they look like furries, because I have some kind of like weird
fetish.
I do have some weird fetishes, and that's exactly my point, is that I don't got nothing against the furries, because some of the shit I'm into is way weirder than furries, but I just
basketball hoops.
Mm-hmm. Don't get me started. I'm literally, the FCC will find us. They will institute new laws to censor the internet just to stop me from talking about my fetishes.
Surprisingly, you're not allowed within 30 feet of a Home Depot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Mexicans did not take kindly to it. the illegal immigrants. Where was I going? Sorry, I just
indie games.
I just started googling some of my favorite
porn. XBLA.
The dust thing. I don't find it offensive or gross in any way. I just find it kind of a really dull art style. Like, I'm not super into the anthropomorphic talking animal thing. Like, I don't think that's an interesting aesthetic.
Sure,
but technically, it is pretty amazing.
Yeah, like everything about that game except for that one part looks incredible to me.
And did you say it was made by like one guy?
It's like, yeah, one guy. One guy developed it. I mean, obviously, there's more than one guy doing voices and probably helped, like, you know, get it on XBLA and stuff like that. But I'm pretty sure the core development was done by one dude. That's why it took him like 6 years to do it too.
Yeah, garage game development, man. It's where the money's at.
Maybe not the money.
Maybe not the money.
that's where the art is at, though.
You know where the money is also not at is apparently Nintendo Power.
Oh yeah,
and future publishing. Yeah, Tyler, can you tell us a little bit about this?
So the December issue will be the last issue for Nintendo Power. I guess Nintendo is kind of cutting off or ending their deal is ending with Future. Is it what's Future Publishing, I guess.
Future Publishing, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's the end of the Nintendo Power December issue, I guess. And, yeah, so I guess they're not going to pick it up by themselves. Nintendo's not going to do anything on their own, so...
Could they even do that, pick it up by themselves and keep the Nintendo Power name?
I'm sure.
I think they could, but... Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose there's like a PlayStation, the official magazine and stuff. Okay. I suppose there are magazines that have the names of the.
And Future already publishes a Nintendo magazine, I think, separate from Power. I think so. I know there's a few Nintendo branded magazines on shelves, and I think I'm kind of confident Future does another Nintendo one, but I think it may be only UK, it may not be US.
Okay.
When has Nintendo Power been relevant lately?
This news story popped, and it, like every comment on Twitter was like, "I'm really sad about Nintendo Power publishing," and then them continuing to talk about like, man. When I was a kid, I loved Nintendo Power, like every last one of them. Like nobody saying, I still read Nintendo Power. It was all, when I was a kid, Nintendo Power was the shit.
Yeah.
So everybody stopped.
Neither of you guys, I take, are a current subscriber of Nintendo Power, are you?
Is anybody?
I am. I actually am. Nobody is. In December, no one will be. No, I am. Yeah. I try to subscribe to as many gaming magazines as I can, which is very few these days. There's not much left.
So that's where our paychecks go.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
To Maxim.
To Maxim.
Dead Tree Media.
Future will be supplanting my Nintendo Power magazine subscription with Maxim.
Environmentalists, send your hate mail to @CoolRats.
That's what happened with. Was it EGM? Where EGM fulfilled?
Yeah, it was EGM.
It was with Maxim. I remember. I'm like, I don't want Maxim. You can give me Cigar World if you want. I'll take Tennis Monthly, but I don't want Maxim. But they gave me Maxim anyways. I think it's probably why I still get Maxim is because of that stupid thing. But anyways.
Yeah, because you haven't canceled your subscription, maybe?
Yeah. Oh, I don't pay for it. I haven't paid for Maxim since, like, 98 or 99.
I kind of want to. Why did you pay for it at all? Like, come on, Deli. Like,
Nintendo Power.
Go
ahead. Well, I was gonna chime in, but I'll let you go first.
You still first. Deli, I love you, and you can go first.
So...
catchphrase.
I get Nintendo Power and I try to skim through it as fast as I can because it's not a great magazine. There's some nice features in there, especially when they talk to developers stuff. It's some kind of like deep, you know, inside baseball type stuff that's actually kind of interesting. But when they talk about games, if they review a game, you know, every game by Nintendo gets like a 9 or 10. Or like one of like the major third party developers gets like a 9. So there's you don't really look at their review scores in Nintendo Power. You don't look at their previews because it's everything you already know because it's already been on the web longer. But what I really did like about them was kind of their more quirky, non typical gaming stuff that brought me back to reading the magazine. And so I almost wish that they'd go back to. I know GamePro tried it by trying to do a quarterly magazine, but unfortunately GamePro failed miserably. I think Nintendo could put out a quarterly magazine, like a special magazine, a special edition where they focus on. And they just had one where they focused on like the history of Mario games, and they showed a bunch of different Mario games in there. They could do that kind of thing. And Nintendo has that just really kind of focus on the retro aspect and. Do these quarterly magazines where they, you know, I guess do that kind of thing. I mean, I would be much more interested in reading those things than you know, the current issue that shows Just Dance 4.
Yeah.
Really?
And
that's what's in the current issue?
I think so. Well, I mean, the current issue of every gaming magazine. The current issue of every gaming magazine is some form of Just Dance or Gears of War. You know, I mean, it's what sells. Whatever.
Yes.
But no, I'd rather see that kind of thing. Obviously, strategy guides, all that is already online. They do make for really pretty tabletop books, and I think that's maybe where the whole gaming magazine thing could go, is like a boutique, really nice boutique book format, or like a hardcover format, or a,
you know what? if Game Informer released a hardcover format every month for their new cover with their
gorgeous covers,
I would totally subscribe to Game Informer. But I'm sure it would cost them like 3 times more than it does now to do it in hardcover than paperback.
Yeah. I mean, Nintendo Power used to put out these really nice posters.
I remember that.
And they were actually kind of cool. And they just stopped them like recently, like within the last year.
Oh, really? I thought that was like always their thing.
Yeah, it used to be, but no, they've stopped putting those out a little while ago.
They ran out of trees. That's what happened. That's what happens when you do this. That's your fault, Dally, is because you subscribe to these dead tree media that are fucking destroying our environment. And this is the cause. This is what happened.
This is the plan all along. No, but yeah. I'd love to see a boutique magazine. I could much rather get into that kind of thing than a monthly gaming magazine. I mean, even look at like our friend Randy Nelson, who put Pixel Mag out there. After 2 issues, he realized that it's just difficult to compete with online media. You know, he had the iPad magazine that was devoted to games,
which doesn't have that much competition, right?
I mean, it doesn't have that much competition. No,
I mean, I guess Game Informer now has an iPad app, but
even still, it's people react to those a little bit differently. I think the stuff that's much more successful, and this is where companies like Nintendo and Sony, Microsoft, if they're doing, or even like the major publishers, do their own magazine type of thing. But take a look at what Jeff Keighley does with his Final Hours of books, like, or his apps. So he did the Portal 2 one. He just did the Mass Effect 3 one. And they were both excellent. And it's just focusing on one game, the development of that game, their screenshots, their videos. I think that is
okay.
Where...
That'd be that. You know what? That I think you're onto something there. Yeah, that would be kind of an amazing idea. I think too.
Yeah, I would love to see
if there was a Game Informer branded storybook that came out every month or so, and it was just about one story about specific game and like the inner workings inside baseball of that game, or some kind of inside story about that game of like the people behind it or something, you know. And it was just about that like telling a tale rather than like trying to present news and information to me and stuff like that. Yeah. Maybe have some reviews at the back of the book or something.
Well, I mean, news and information and even reviews, we get that, you know, we get that now online. Every publication, every online magazine, every online website like SideQuesting does news and reviews and previews, so I'd much rather read the story of how games
develop. You got to put some kind of extra content in there, otherwise you have like 3 guys who do this like documentary. Like you put a bunch of writers out of business if you don't have some kind of extraneous content in there. Maybe even just pepper out some. I don't know how you do that. Maybe do some extra. I mean, you don't have to do news, I don't think, because doing news in a print media is, you know, it's just it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
it doesn't make sense now.
But reviews, I think, if you do something interesting with the layout, and then maybe. And you know, put it at the back of the book, or you know, at chapter intervals, like take intermissions for having like a well-designed, interesting review in the middle, and like then you get to chapter 2 of the tale of, you know, the making of Halo 4 or whatever. That might be interesting.
I'm sure.
I'm looking at like the Penny Arcade Report. It's almost like they're kind of an example of why you would really want to do a magazine, because like all their stuff is long form, and they don't, you know, they did it on website form, and it's working just fine. It seems like if you're trying to make a magazine
against magazines.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. Like you get like a magazine with like long form stuff. There's no reason to do that in a magazine format. Why don't you just make it a website and still do the long form stuff? I don't know.
The fact that I have an iPad that is a large thing that I can carry with me, that like I can literally flip pages like a page, and I can just go to a website and read long form content like that in that kind of sense, that by itself is just like a great argument against something like Nintendo Power and I hate to say it, even something like Randy's concept, because Randy's thing is like requires me to dip out of what I'm already using anyway, which is my browser, you know, Google Chrome on my iOS app, you know, device or whatever. I can just flip between that and like my weird porn and switch over to the, you know, to long form content like Ben Kuchera's. You know, say what you want about Ben Kuchera, but and the Penny Arcade Report's existence at all, but it's, you know what, it's working to, it's doing what it meant to do, and it's doing it well. You know, it's not failing at that. It is succeeding. You know.
Well, it's you know, it definitely heralds the end of I mean, we've been seeing the end of print magazines coming for a long time. Obviously, GamePro, EGM came back, but they're still not. They're never going to be what they used to be. And look, I mean, Game Informer and At Gamer are backed by GameStop,
retailers,
and retailers. Yeah. And that may be the direction to go in, at least to monetarily, you know, finance this kind of stuff. But
I mean, it puts your just even beyond like the financial investment of the mm-hmm. retailer, it puts your product in front of the eyes of the audience, of your target audience, day in and day out. People are always shopping at Best Buy, and people are always shopping at GameStop. Although that might come to an end eventually too, you know, with digital distribution and stuff. When does that by itself, and when does GameStop stop existing, and then what happens to Game Informer after GameStop goes away?
Yeah, it's
that could look bad for Game Informer.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, they kind of live on their exclusives. I mean, other than that, I mean, I justify my subscription by just reading the features they do, and that's pretty much it. I don't really read the reviews online, so you know, I don't really see them surviving much longer if GameStop were to go out. So,
and
or at least
I mean,
dropped.
Eventually, GameStop will go out because there's going to come a point where like GameStop can. You know, or at least the brick and mortar version of GameStop. Maybe in the future, GameStop becomes like a Steam or something like that. I mean, they purchased Impulse from Stardock, you know, so they're trying to do that. Although I don't know that how necessarily well that's working. They're selling digital download codes in their store, but eventually there's going to come a point when people have gotten past the psychological barrier against buying something online, or the you know, I mean, and they just fucking stop buying download codes, stop buying point cards, you know, in general,
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, that's going to go away.
Well, we'll pour one out for Nintendo Power. Last episode.
Oh,
the
thing that we kept interrupting each other
about
is I wanted to ask you guys quick before we move on from Nintendo Power. I wanted to ask you, each of you, the first time you started subscribing to Nintendo Power or your first Nintendo Power mm-hmm. memory, just as a kind of a...
Sure.
Pouring a 40 out for them, you know.
Well, me being the oldest of the crew today, I started with I'd always known about Nintendo Power. I knew about the Fun Club.
Back when Nintendo Power was founded, you were actually a newspaper mogul.
Exactly.
You had already built your empire because
you were
an old man by then.
Yeah, I had started New York Times. If people don't know that. No, known about Nintendo Power and the Fun Club, and I saw the really cool. They actually had some really amazing magazine covers because they did the claymation Mario Brothers for new first Super Mario Brothers 2. They had they had the Simon Belmont holding Dracula's head, but it was actually a guy dressed up. So they did these really nice
The Legend of Zelda 2, where Zelda was sleeping on the bed, but it was a mannequin in a pink dress.
Yeah, it was like they had some high production value out of the covers. They did a really good job.
I think you took what I just said in a completely different direction than what I just said.
they put more effort into their covers. I'm gonna end it there. No, I'd always been
I get what you're saying. There was effort.
And I'd always been interested in subscribing to it. I had never subscribed to a magazine before, but then they announced the Dragon Warrior, which is Dragon Quest, the Dragon Warrior tie-in, where if you get your subscription, you get Dragon Warrior for free. And so we did that, and that was awesome. So we did that. My brother and I, that was our Christmas present. We got a 1 year subscription to Nintendo Power, and we got Dragon Warrior as the NES cartridge. That's what they sent us. It was fantastic.
For the youngs out there, Dragon Warrior is Dragon Quest.
Yeah, I already said that.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay, never mind. I'm sorry. I'm one of the olds.
Oh, now I understand.
I firmly make it a point that Nintendo Power got me into RPGs, which dominated my game playing from the NES and Super NES and PlayStation eras, because it was all because of Dragon Warrior, Dragon Quest.
Was Dragon Quest / Warrior your first RPG?
Yes, that was my first RPG. I had played Zelda, and
that's
I had played Zelda 2. But this was my first real kind of much more traditional JRPG that I'd come across. So it was that, and then I think a few months later, Final Fantasy came out, which blew Dragon Warrior away, and then you had Dragon Warrior 2 and Dragon Warrior 3, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that was my, that's my original, that's my oldest memory of first getting into Nintendo Power. What about you guys?
Tyler, what about you?
Yeah, so I'm younger, so I didn't really ever have a subscription to Nintendo Power, but I remember going to my friend's house all the time, and he always had, like, stacks of them, and we would always, like, grab, like, the newest one and, like, talk about it and, like, and talk about the games and stuff like that, and then go play, and then go out and, like, beg his mom to go buy the game that we saw and reviewed and everything. And I also remember, like, going to the store and always, you know, picking up a issue of it on a newsstand thing, or and but, like, I don't know, I guess most of my memories come from kind of just browsing through it. I don't think I ever really read it. I was like, oh, look at all these pictures, and that game got a good score. That's a Mario game. I want to go buy that. So it was mostly Game Informer when I actually started reading this stuff. But yeah, I mean, I remember Nintendo Power pretty fondly. But
you know what was really interesting about Nintendo Power was that they didn't have advertising up until like the early 2000s. They were completely funded by Nintendo for the longest time and just survived off some subscription money. And so it wasn't until like, I think it was like either 99 or 2000 or 2001 where they actually started taking advertising money. So, Steven, what about you?
I never had a subscription to Nintendo Power. In fact, my only Nintendo Power memory at all is that at my grandma's house, there was a big giant box where she kept all of the video game paraphernalia. And we weren't really Nintendo kids at the time. We were Sega kids. So we had a Sega Genesis in there, as well as like a copy of like the Sega 6-pack, which had like Shinobi and Streets of Rage and shit in it. But in that box, for like no discernible reason, was one single copy of Nintendo Power that we would leaf through over and over and over again as kids, just looking at the same articles and same shit over and over. I can't for the life of me remember anything about what was actually inside of it, but I just remember that there was a Nintendo Power magazine inside of the bottom of this box, kind of lining the bottom of this shoebox, and every weekend when we were done, we would, you know, pack the Sega Genesis on top of it and put it back in the crawl space and go home. And for some reason, we just kept leafing through that same thing again. Never had any interest in getting any of this stuff. I don't know what it was. It was just one of those childhood things that you do for, like, out of this, like, weird sense of tradition or something at a certain point, I guess. I don't know.
I think for me, it was weird seeing, like, video games, like, I don't know, like in a magazine, like, I don't know, I guess I've only seen like my parents' magazines, like, whoa, hey, the thing I like is in these things too. So
maybe that was it. Maybe it was like some subconscious like sense of justification, like saying to myself, like, I like video games, and clearly video games are a legitimate thing to like because they're in a magazine and that makes it official, or maybe, you know, even though at the time actually I didn't get into video games really heavily years and years later, not until really PlayStation 1 and even PlayStation 2 era did I get into
I
really get into video games. But I played games. I never my obsession didn't start until way later.
So pour one out for Nintendo Power. Last issue is December of this year. So you got about, what, 3 issues left. So that's the end of an era there for many people who grew up reading gaming magazines.
It's the end of an era that effectively ended 10 years ago when they all stopped reading it.
Yeah. I wonder what will happen to the staff. I wonder who those writers.
Apparently, some of those are being transitioned to other future publications. You have to understand. I think from what I've heard, is a lot of those guys are like, there's a lot of freelancers on the magazines, and there's a lot of staffers do write for other things already. So I think there's, from what I know, there's very few members that are just completely dedicated to Nintendo Power anymore. So, because they actually did do a pretty big staff overhaul when Future bought the rights to the magazine way back when, and Future kind of put in their own writers and their own staff and been slowly injecting some of their folks. So I don't think you'll have a huge issue with those guys getting, you know, continuing working either at Future or somewhere similar. So, but yeah, Nintendo Power ending. You know what's not ending is me playing games. I've actually started playing some more lately. Surprisingly,
now that's the end of an era.
That's the end of an era. Me not
the end of the era where Deli didn't play video games.
Yeah, so I made a point that this summer I was going to start cranking through as many games as I could, and I've been doing it. I'm very proud of myself. I was kicking butt on Mass Effect 3 before I went on this vacation, and so 10 days in Eastern Europe got me to. I took my 3DS with me, and I took my.
You mean Narnia, right?
No, it's Narnia. Yeah, Macedonia. I took my PS Vita with me, and I took my 3DS. Well, I didn't bring the adapter to charge my the proper wall adapter to charge, because they have a different outlet system over there, a different voltage. So if you
it's third world country, so like you need to prepare for that stuff.
It's also just non-US. Is probably the best way to say it, Steven.
I think what you should have said was also has like one of the most violent military forces on the earth that will track you down.
One of the most oppressive military forces on the planet. No, so I wasn't able to charge my 3DS, and I think it actually just shut off on me on the flight, the 8-hour flight over to Europe. So, I had just kind of
because that's got such a longer battery.
Well, the Vita does last longer, especially in sleep mode, because it doesn't have to do any of the other like Street Pass and Spot Pass stuff. But I was able to actually
Vita
charge
lasts
the Vita
longer, as long as you don't play it.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually able to charge the Vita because I had my USB cable. I just grabbed the USB cable from the Vita charger and. Was able to plug it into computers and such and charge. So I did play the Vita a lot.
That's something that never would have even occurred to me. That like, yeah, I guess your 3DS like has its own special proprietary adapter a charger. I guess you can't just like plug that shit into into a computer. But I guess you can do that with the Vita.
And
this was the justification for that stupid fucking power cord this whole time. We just didn't know it.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's one of those things where it's, you know, everything should be able to be charged. Every consumer electronics product of that size should be able to be charged with USB cable, because it just makes, for travel, it makes things so much easier than having to lug around all these separate adapters for wall outlets that don't work. Just get a USB cable.
I'm gonna be dead serious with you, Dali. This is something that I didn't even know how to put into words until you just brought this up in front of me.
Sure.
But that's, I think, one of my biggest things about, subconsciously, that keeps me thinking of the Vita as like a piece of hardware and technology and like a inclusive device that works with everything you own and everything, as opposed to the 3DS, which I always think of, like, especially any
Nintendo product or
Nintendo handheld anyway, which I always think of as toys. Something about the fact that it can only plug into, it's only got the one plug-in that can only plug into a wall, it can't connect to anything else in any other way, you're just charging it up to do the one thing that it does. You know, which is play video games, or you know, I mean, it has Netflix and shit, but that's all, you know, over the Wi-Fi in the air and up in the cloud and whatnot. So that's basically magic. I think that's somehow, for some reason, that is like some it creates some mental block in my head that makes me think of it as like the same thing as like charging up my remote controlled car as a child or something. Like it makes it feel more like a toy to me as opposed to a piece of technology that I want to use.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely investing in a USB charge cable, which I can get for like $2 online for the 3DS and for the DSi XL. So, it's just one of those things. I mean, it's actually, I think, what was it, the iPhone and the iPods were like the first things to start charging through USB on a regular basis. So
I bet you there was something that did it.
I'm sure there's some stuff before then, yeah. But these are like the Vita is nice at just charged through a USB, and it's actually very cool. I didn't even consider grabbing a 3DS USB charger until like the day before I left, and of course they don't really sell them in stores. You have to order them through like Amazon and stuff. So, but regardless, I played my Vita all the time, and on this vacation. So what I played was Temple of Montezuma Blitz, which I think is maybe one of the greatest games ever created. No, I'm just kidding. It's a like puzzle gem game. So I have this great device in the Vita, this really nice piece of hardware, and I'm playing like 25-year-old puzzle games on there. Great job, Dally.
Did you download that, or is
it's
that
it's a free to play? It's a free game to download. One of those things where I was sitting at home the day before I flew out, and I thought, you know, let me see what games I could download to the really tiny Vita memory card that would still fit on there. And Temple of Montezuma Blitz was available, and it's free, and it fit on my memory card. So I played that. I picked up Mod Nation Racers a little while back when it was on sale for like $9 or $8. Yeah, that game is not very good. It's it's just playing that game really does not make me excited at all for Little Big Planet karting, because I'm starting to think, man, if it ends up being more of what this is, then it's just not good, and it's not easy to create tracks. So for those people who don't know, Mod Nation Racers is Sony's complete ripoff of Mario Kart for Sony platforms, and they use this as part of their kind of create play series where you're supposed to look, you know,
play create share, I think.
Play create share, yeah, where you can kind of create your own characters, your own tracks, and you're meant to share them with people. It's very difficult to do anything outside of a basic track in creation for Mod Nation Racers on the Vita, especially even with all the touchscreen stuff.
I think to call it a ripoff of Mario Kart, though, that's what she said, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a little bit disingenuous, just because at this point, like, the kart racer is a genre itself at this point. There are enough kart racers out there where, like, it's not just this isn't like the Super Smash Brothers Sony All-Stars thing, or PlayStation All-Stars one game that does this. Like, there are other kart racers. This is a genre.
That's very true. This is a genre. It's not like, it'd be like me calling...
They all did the same thing.
It'd be like me calling all fighting games ripoffs of Street Fighter 2, you know, so... that's true. It's just that having come off of Mario Kart 7, which is a fantastic kart racing game, tons of fun. Obviously, it's lacking in things that other bigger racing games don't have. But it's
lacking in things that other games don't have. Gotcha.
I'm sorry. Well, let me phrase this way: if Mario Kart allowed you to create your own tracks in an easy to do novel way, then you'd have a fantastic.
Mario Kart allowed you to make your own tracks, Nintendo would never allow you to share those tracks with people online, because they'd be like, "Oh, well, people are just going to make a track shaped like a giant Wang." Exists in Mod Nation Racers, but they would.
You were able to create your own battle levels on Smash Brothers and trade them back and forth online.
A level where you played on a giant Wang?
Yes, I did. I played on several.
That's the only one I played on.
That's the only one I played on over and over again. No, so back to Mod Nation Racers. So it's the game is kind of inconsistent. There's some really nice design touches, like the graphical design stuff is really cool when the user interface, when you're kind of scrolling through the menus and stuff, works really well. But then it's overlaid with these really rasterized, like, GIF images with just jagged edges all over the place. It's really bizarre to see. It's like somebody cut and paste something off of in Photoshop onto a really pretty background. You get that little. It's just kind of awkward, you know.
But, it's the Doom thing, right? Like, it's sprites.
Yeah, exactly. It's sprite. It's like taking a sprite and throwing it onto a painted background. So. That's some of the graphical user interface stuff. The actual gameplay wise, it's just not original, and the level design is not. Level design is really. It doesn't just leave things lacking. There are sections in the levels that you're racing around. Well, I'm still jet lagged. That's why I'm blubbering a lot. By the way, guys, I want to apologize. There are sections in the levels where just the slightest wrong move on the track will send you either careening off an edge or get you stuck inside a barrier. And it happened a lot. I got stuck in so many barriers in Mod Nation Racers that you'd have to restart the race.
Dally, here's the trick to that is when that happens, the little man in the cloud with his fishing rod will float down to you and pull you up out of the hazard and put you back on the track again. And you're all good until you get hit by a blue shell.
I see, hit by a blue shell. And so that's one of the bad design things is that, yeah, you can get trapped either off the track or on the track and not be able to do anything. You're just kind of stuck. You can't jump with Mod Nation Racers. You can't do a lot of those things that you can do with some other kart racing games. And so I found myself restarting races a lot in order to get that, to avoid some of these pitfalls. The other thing is that you don't realize how important rubber banding is to fun in a game. And Nintendo does it in some respects good, some respects bad. It's bad when you're in the lead and somebody gets a blue shell and drops you into like fourth or fifth place. But in Mod Nation Racers, if you're in eighth place and you've passed one lap, it's a three-lap race. Your chances are you getting into second or third or first are impossible.
I think part difficult. Of the problem with that is that rubber banding is important to the fun of you because you are terrible at video games.
Yeah, terrible at video games.
I don't know how serious I can take the. No, actually, you know what? You know, obviously, you know more about cars and racing games than I ever will. You've forgotten more about the shit than I ever will.
Sure,
but it's just. Ever since you told me that you found Wipeout 2048 to be too hard for you when that is like the or too fast for you when that is the slowest moving Wipeout game in the franchise, I have found it difficult to quite get a bead on your level of proficiency in racing games.
So my proficiency is this: I'm not a fan of the F-Zero games. I think those F-Zero and Wipeout, the kind of futuristic racing game isn't really my thing. Simulation racing games, I'm just madly in love with, like Forza and Gran Turismo and so forth. Need for Speed, because they're very realistic in terms of controls, and you expect having to do certain things to advance in a race. You know, if you're last in a race, you kind of know what you have to do and what corners you have to cut to catch up to everybody else. It's not rubber banding, it's just skilled racing. Mod Nation Racers and kart racing, let's say kart racing games like Mario Kart, it's purely fun. It's just bonkers, off-the-wall racing, explosions, drag, you know, pitfalls, lavas, that kind of shit. And rubber banding is expected because you don't want to not have fun playing a kart racing game. You want to always be in the mix.
Do you think maybe that this is more of a failing of the game, or do you think that you just have difficulty getting into the right mindset? Maybe I'm wondering if maybe that like Mod Nation Racers is like the like a Viva Pinata type game. I've not played any Mod Nation Racers games, I should point out, so I can't make any informed comment.
I think that Mod Nation Racers hangs a little bit. I think it's the design of the game. It puts a little bit too much simulation into the kart racing genre. You know, so it's like. It's almost like there's too much of a focus on racing correctly rather than having fun and blowing shit up.
It's the Viva Pinata effect.
Like, I haven't played Viva Pinata.
It's a cutesy fucking like colorful confetti fest, but then the actual gameplay itself is like this really
much more serious,
far more simmy, far more, you know, I don't hesitate to use the term deep, but deep experience.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to say it. It mixes the two, let's say the two extreme racing genres, kart racing and simulation racing, in kind of the wrong way. I haven't played any other Mod Nation Racing games. I know there's a couple others out there, but I've just played this Vita the Vita version. But it just doesn't seem to work very well. It feels rushed. I think that's probably the my big issue with it, because it has all those pitfalls and the tracks are designed so that. Or the tracks aren't designed to let you catch up. I know that I heard a lot of good things about the first Mod Nation Racing game for the PS3. I think it was the PS3.
Yeah, it was PS3.
And so I mean that people put a lot of time and effort into it. Not that they didn't with this one, but definitely I don't think it was clearly as much time and effort in this as they did in some of the other games, because it does feel rushed. It feels like it's lacking certain.
Was it a launch game for the Vita?
Yeah.
It was launch
road trip. Mod Nation Racers road trip. Yeah, yeah, it was.
Yeah,
off road or
yeah, whatever it is. I think it's road.
Road rage, title, road rash.
Vita.
So there's tons of stuff to do in Mod Nation Racers, but it just doesn't come off as fun, and it, like I said, there's just parts of the game which are just kind of tedious, and the races don't let you, like I said, they just don't let you catch up when they should. They should let you catch up a little bit. There should be some rubber banding, or at least a better rubber banding in this. So, yeah, that's that. I did offset that, though, with Sound Shapes, which I find to be... so I downloaded that right before I left for vacation. I find that to be a ton of fun. It's just such a really nicely designed... This is a game that's just pure design, right? So it's audio.
This was the game. This is was your Vita game, right? This was the game that you were waiting for the Vita, to justify your purchase of the Vita, wasn't it?
This kind of game, I guess. Yeah. So Sound Shapes and, well, Mutant Blobs Attack and now Sound Shapes are my two absolute favorite Vita games. And oddly enough, they're both by independent developers.
And they both star a small circular blob that can suck itself inwards to stick to surfaces.
And they both are on.
Maybe the blob genre is.
They're not exclusive.
The blob genre is my favorite genre now.
That's true, actually. I forgot. Mutant Blobs Attack on PC now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. And A Boy and His Blob was a thing for a while. But it's just a really nicely designed game. I mean, maybe what I like about both these games is their art style is really fantastic. The audio is great. The mechanics are super easy to understand, and everything just works, right? And so with Sound Shapes, you play a blob and you get through, it's a kind of a two, like a side scrolling platforming game.
It's not kind of a side scrolling
It is a side scrolling platforming game. That has some puzzle elements involved based on how you stick to different surfaces and jump. So far, I've played it for a few hours. So far, the music stuff is just kind of secondary. It doesn't really do anything to enhance. It's more of an enhancement rather than a puzzle solving thing.
We should explain like how the music works in the game, right?
Yeah,
the coins and everything.
Yeah. So the way you get. So as you're doing these levels, you get these things called coins. So there's these icons floating around.
These abstract concepts that you may never have heard of.
Aren't
we're going to put this in, like, just so you know, that was Dally putting coins in quotes in his speech there, like things called coins.
Well,
you may be familiar with them from video game franchises like Mario.
Well, they're not traditional coins. So it's not like an actual, it doesn't look like a coin. It's just like a round circular thing. And so... You jump on it.
It's a coin. What are you saying?
No, it's not a traditional coin.
What are the words that are coming out of your mouth?
This is like a round circular monetary element is what this is. You can it's
made of semi-precious metal and pressed in a government mint. You know, I don't understand where you're getting coin from.
And so you grab one of these coins and it activates a sound, right? So depending on what point of the stage you do, you get it. So either kind of higher levels of the stage, lower levels, you get a different pitch, different sound effects. So, and the sounds are the music of the level and the sounds are all based off of different musicians. So you'll have like the worlds are albums. So you have like a whole like dMouse album. So all the levels within the dMouse album are based on kind of dMouse's music, and you have a Beck album, you have, you know, so on and so forth. So
Beck album is really good, by the way, isn't it?
Yeah,
like
it's
whole
fantastic.
not just the music, but the level design of that thing. That's like the last one, I think,
and
or second to last, or
and
something.
And that's the part
that's just really good.
That's the part right. that I really enjoy is not so much the music; it's just the level design is fantastic. From every level has different color.
I think that is where the music part. I'm gonna hijack this for just a second because I played Sound Shapes 2 and I fucking love it. And I just wanted to say, like, the Beck level, like the way that's when the music and the gameplay start to really become part of one another the environment starts changing based on the beat of the level of the music of the level. So you have like these giant shockwave explosions chasing you, but increase in size as the beat keeps going. So like every beat in the tempo, there is a like another layer added to this like deadly wave coming after you, and then like the environment is actually like forms out of the lyrics that are being sung by Beck into the song. So it's like as he's saying these words are appearing on screen, and you use those words as platforms to jump around and stuff. And I think that's really cool. It's just I wish that kind of thing could be more used in
In the other albums and in the creation stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's The creation stuff is a little bit tamed back because they obviously they don't really let you record your own audio, lyrics, that kind of stuff. But it's a little tamed down. But for this first game, and after playing this, there's gonna have to be a Sound Shapes 2 or some type of DLC with other artists coming. But it's just a fantastic experience. The level design is beautiful. The game is gorgeous, 2D. I really see this as just one of those games that you've got to own. I mean, I'm working on the review for this as well, but I'm a little spoiler. It's just one of the best little portable gaming experiences you can have in a while. I'm surprised that it hasn't. I'm not surprised, I should say, but I'm half expecting a game like this to appear on the iPad and iPhone at some point. But it just works really well on the Vita. It's just a fantastic little game. So. Definitely worth checking out. You may want to check out On Live before it collapses, by the way. Or you may not, actually, because On Live has collapsed and it's been reborn like a phoenix. Into
with the same CEO and everything.
With the same CEO into On Live.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, so it's about what? So about 2 weeks ago.
On Live is evolving.
So about 2 weeks ago or so, On Live, rumors came out that On Live was closing, that the entire staff had been laid off, and then they kind of shot it down at first, but then by the end of that weekend, they had confirmed that, On Live had closed down and was basically on the brink of it being bankrupt, right? The brink of just shutting down completely. They had very few dollar bills, y'all, to survive, and they only had just
which
a few
is
days
weird
left.
Because it's like you'd never heard anything. I don't know. Yeah. It was just like, well, it was kind of shocking to me when they first heard about it.
Well, we never.
I think I started worrying about On Live like when they started offering like a free game if you liked them on Facebook or something like that at some point.
Or happened. Like reduce it to a dollar or something crazy.
I think.
Yeah. They had some. Actually, they had some really good sales. They had some like.
Yeah.
They had some like $5 Friday deal sales things, but I never went into any of it because I didn't want a version of a game that I couldn't just play like a regular game, you know.
Well, they started with a subscription fee, and then they got rid of it, I think, in like...
No, there never was a subscription fee. The original plan was to have a subscription fee,
right.
And then by the time On Live actually came out, they had changed their mind. So, this subscription fee that was sort of looming over everyone's heads never actually happened.
No, there is. There is kind of like a basic subscription fee that gets you like classic games.
Like there's a premium tier or something like that.
There's some
that's
type
free to play,
tier that you pay.
Even though this is not
free
to play, you have to still pay for the games.
Yeah. It's like, I think it's like a monthly tier, but you get the classic games. You don't get the new release stuff.
Mm.
But you get access to all those. What's that?
It was PlayStation Plus.
Essentially, it was like PlayStation Plus before PlayStation Plus, yeah.
Was that before? I think PlayStation Plus might have been before On Live.
No. On Live was definitely before PS Plus.
Yeah. On Live was definitely before.
On Live was like 2009, I think they announced it, right? They were in a lot of debt, or they're very near to being in debt. They shut the company down and spun off their debts into a separate company, and rebirth themselves as On Live again, which is what it's actually a really common practice in the business world to do that. General Motors just did that.
You kind of cut out there for a second for me.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, he did for me.
Sorry, General Motors just did that, so it's a very common thing to do in the business world, is to kind of spin off your broken assets and start up a new company. But so they did that. They've kept maybe about half their staff or like a third of their staff or so. Half, yeah. And they kept their same CEO. They kept a lot of their upper management. They got purchased by an investor who was already an investor in them, but I think just kind of took the entire investment upon themselves now. They said it's going to be business as usual. Users aren't going to notice anything. They still got specials and deals and prizes and contests and all kinds of stuff coming up. But you've got to start to wonder now that, hey, this is the first sign that something really bad is going down with On Live. Up until now, you didn't hear anything about it. You just thought they were kind of chugging along, doing their thing. Maybe potentially being bought out by another company, or integrated into another service or, you know, put into Ouya. That can be their saving grace. But
by the way, just a quick interruption. OnLive came out, was launched in America, in North America, 12 days before PlayStation Plus went live.
There you go.
PlayStation Plus was announced a year before OnLive went live in North America. So
we didn't
take that how you will. That's what I've been doing this whole time. Sorry, Dali, were you talking? I can't remember.
No, I was saying we didn't know the details of PlayStation Plus. PlayStation Plus didn't become PlayStation Plus until recently when they started offering free games and stuff. So, anyways, as I was saying, so they had a lot of bad stuff going on. Nobody really knew about it. They were always kind of chugging along. And now we're starting to see there's a few screws loose. The wheels could potentially fall off at any point. And what does this mean for streaming gaming? Because you look at Gaikai. Sony just purchased Gaikai for $300 million. I think Sony was actually interested in OnLive at some point.
They made it sound like they were.
A lot of people were interested in OnLive, but the CEO or whatever, or the founder or whatever, was unwilling to sell OnLive for anything less than $1 billion. That was their actual number. Was
and
$1 billion.
And now that's gonna be very difficult to get anything near that.
And he wanted to retain total control over the IP or the technology or something like that. And Gaikai, on the other hand, took it the complete opposite way. It was like they were a company that built themselves to be sold to somebody and then made a whole bunch of money. And we see where the alternate choice led to OnLive.
You look at OnLive was definitely it is a brand, right? It's a branded product right now. And you look at Gaikai is completely secondary. I mean, Gaikai will probably still exist as a name internally in Sony as the technology, but it'll just be Sony Cloud Streaming or whatever they come up with. But I think OnLive's biggest competitors weren't Gaikai. I think Gaikai is kind of it's a different system. It's more for publishers to put their games out because you can already play some of the games on Facebook and in browsers.
I think you could do a demo of Dead Space 2 before it came out.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the ways they had Gaikai.
Yeah, so there's
that kind of direction is an interesting direction, but OnLive wasn't going that way.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was an advantage that Gaikai had because it worked in a different level.
What was that, Tyler? What was that thing at the end that you just did? Were you snoring in the middle of,
of
this podcast while you're awake?
I don't know what that was, no.
I can't be the only one. Maybe I just had a stroke. You guys smell pepper in here?
At the end? Maybe
I heard it.
I don't know.
I heard it. Maybe,
I heard some gnarly sounds coming into this
separate listener.
Into this headset. I have had a stroke.
A secret listener. No, I think OnLive's biggest competitor was probably Steam. Wouldn't you say? Because
certainly not direct competitor.
Yeah,
well,
not direct
services, but competitor, as a thing that sells video games.
Well, I would say competitor as a thing online that you can, you can access it from any computer that you have access to. Yeah, you have to re-download the game, but you can play all your purchased games.
Yeah, it's probably a fair. Yeah, I mean, they were pretty close. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you were on a PC and you wanted to play a game, I'd probably go to either OnLive. If you have a crappy PC, then go to OnLive. If you have a capable, you go to Steam.
Yeah. And I think enough people have – I think Steam's grown enough, especially over the last few years, that OnLive would always be a second choice, right, to anything like that, even with brand new games. I mean, new games are day and date on Steam now. Right, so you had Darksiders 2, you got Call of Duty, you got all those popping up on Steam instantly.
Dark Souls came on Prepare to Die Edition came out a day ahead of time for no reason.
Exactly. And so I think that's their biggest competitor.
Well, and the problem with OnLive too is that first person shooters you can't Call of Duty, you can't play Call of Duty multiplayer on OnLive, stuff like that doesn't work at least now.
Yeah, right. The latency is too great.
Latency.
Right.
Well, not only that, but how much bandwidth is chewed up to get, to play these games. I mean, unless you have nothing else streaming in your house, AT&T has a 250 gig cap. I think Comcast has the same thing. Other networks only have a 50 gig cap. You have the potential of if you game really hardcore to just go through your blow through your cap every month.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how many people actually bought those consoles that they had for, well, they still had them, yeah. I guess, but I don't know.
Those consoles were, I mean, the fact that those
tiny.
Consoles
we have
were
one
not amazing were, was tempered by the fact that they were like $99 as well.
We have
I don't
one
know,
here
but,
at
you know, whatever.
Side
this,
HQ.
This whole system only works, like we were saying, because of like latency, or it does not work because of latency. So what we got to do is we got to wait. We're just waiting for that time when, you know, American internet gets to a point where it's not a piece of shit. You know, like you compare American internet to just about any other country in the world, and it's just... It's awful because geographically we've just got too much space to get across. You know, like it's just like the speed of light is acting as the bottleneck on this because we cannot, you know, send data across 300, 400, 500 miles of cable in zero time. So what we got to what's going to happen is we either got to wait for Google to fix all of this for everyone like they do with everything. Or that's what's inside of Peter Molyneux's box, inside of that cube. We're going to all click on that cube, and when we're done, it's going to whatever emerges, it's going to be the solution to everything ever, and we're going to all be playing on live consoles for the next 500 years. It'll start a new golden age of man. The god emperor that is Peter Molyneux will demand the sacrifice of 100 psychics every month to feed his power. It's gonna
this
be
is
great.
All just a logical conclusion.
Yeah, it's gonna be great,
to our
guys.
Existence.
Check my Tumblr. I'm telling you, it's
check
all there.
The Tumblr. So, yeah, OnLive should have let themselves be bought by like Comcast.
Yeah, you're
or...
cutting out completely.
Like, no, I'm here. I hear myself fine. No, I still think OnLive should have been let themselves bought by one of these other companies, like Comcast, integrated into Comcast, and but you know, bought by Warner Brothers, one of the cable companies. I think that would have been the best bet for them. I think they're knocking on death's door right now, and I don't see them surviving, you know, a year from now.
No, no, I mean, it sounds like they're in some kind of like they're not even. It's not like the thing that's been keeping them afloat right now is not something that is like a permanent solution. It sounds like it was some kind of like last minute looky loo, some kind of change up that. That they're doing to as like a last ditch effort to keep themselves in business for just a little bit longer, and I'll bet you now what'll happen is that they'll eventually get bought out by somebody, but at a fraction of the price that was originally offered to them.
Was it OnLive that had the ability to like go to your desktop or a virtual desktop on
yes,
like an
Windows
iPad?
7, Windows 7, yeah.
Yeah, that was only, that was like the most
was that
interesting
OnLive?
Thing.
Yeah, it was OnLive.
I think it was OnLive. Yeah.
There's a program called SplashTop that does that.
No, no. Well, no, but OnLive actually had allowed you to use Windows 7 for free, from your iPad, like a touchscreen version of Windows 7, and you can use a Bluetooth mouse and a Bluetooth keyboard, and you can actually use Windows 7.
Could you play games or something? Could you like start a game from your iPad?
I think. You were severely limited. You had like 5 gigs of online space or 2 gigs of online space or something like that of stored
that's
space.
Small.
Yeah, it's really tiny.
Because I know there was a thing called – there's a program called SplashTop that's free. I think it's free. It might cost less than $2 or something.
Yeah, there's Team Center,
on iPad
Splash
where you can download
Top,
like an app on your desktop and on your iPad, and it literally just OnLive – turns your computer into like an OnLive server and streams whatever to your iPad just – as much as you want. I played EVE Online on my iPad once by doing that. The latency was a bitch, but as like a sort of proof of concept, I mean, I could open up a game and play it.
Yeah, I managed to play Diablo 3 that way.
Well, the online thing, you had to pay a subscription, I think, and it also, it wasn't your computer.
Right,
it was like
right.
just one of theirs.
Yeah. Right, so. And you had to pay for those games from their computer, I imagine.
It was probably their apps.
Man, that just like fucking says a whole lot about the state of technology. When like, yeah, here's this iPad app that does all of this stuff, but way, way better for free. Or you can pay a monthly subscription fee to have the right to have the option of purchasing more things for more money to play an inferior version of an inferior version on your iPad. Great. So we just discovered why OnLive failed. Moving on.
Steven, what have you been playing?
Persona 3 Portable, Darksiders 2, Deponia, Sleepy Dogs, Sound Shapes, and Poppo and Yo.
So let's go in reverse order. We already talked Sound Shapes. Tell me a little bit about Poppo and Yo. Poppo and Yo.
Poppo and Yo, Español, Channel 666. Hey.
Univision. More and more racist every
episode.
None of
this sounds like the Poppo and Yo that I thought in my head.
El Generalissimo. Dun, dun, dun. Coming up next on the soap opera. Mexican. Soap opera.
Is that a reboot of all
Mexican.
Soap operas?
From Mexican.
Soap opera. Soap opera. Soap opera.
Soap opera.
So Poppo and Yo. Bruh.
Tell us, Steven.
Poppo and Yo is a video game.
It's a video game.
All right, Sleepy Dogs.
Poppo and Yo is a game by Minority Media. I think that's the name of the full name of the developer.
Mm-hmm.
It is a game about a. It is autobiographical about a one of the lead designers who grew up with an alcoholic, abusive father in Brazil in the favela. And the game reflects that by putting you in the in control of a kid named Kiko, which is spelled Q-U-I-C-O, for the record.
Sounds like curiosity.
Yeah, it's very much like it's interesting you should mention that because you do go to Mars and you search for ice samples. It's a NASA tie-in game. That was what really surprised me. No, it's you play a kid named Kiko. The first splash image is a dedication, like you would have in a book that just says like, this game or this goes out to all of my sisters, my brothers, my family, whatever he says exactly, who survived the monster in my father. I think something about the monster in his father. It's been a little while since I played the game already. I'm already losing things because I'm one of the olds. So you play this little kid who is hiding in a closet at the very beginning of the game, and like a magical door made out of chalk, Beetlejuice style, opens up, and he escapes from what he is from whatever it is that he is hiding from in this closet, because you can hear it like thundering around outside, and he escapes into this world that is basically looks like a Brazilian favela. But is completely devoid of people and kind of uses magic realism kind of stuff where buildings are kind of look normal at first, but then you'll pull like a lever made of chalk, like a chalk outlines play a big role in the game, and the world will like rearrange itself into strange and twisted shapes and stuff to allow you to progress. And the sort of core concept of gameplay comes from your interactions with Monster, which is this giant sort of gorilla rhino red thing that follows you around that is your friend, and you can kind of direct where he goes and use him to like bounce up on top of buildings and things, and you can direct him around by like shoving, like giving him coconuts, and if he eats too many coconuts he'll fall asleep, but you want to like get him to fall asleep in the right area to allow you to bounce on his belly, to jump around and stuff like that, or to get him to stand on a pressure plate that's too heavy for Kiko, who's a small Brazilian boy, to get around and stuff like that. So it's a fairly standard platformer. You pull a lever, you jump around a bit. You don't really have any abilities, even like very standard style of platformer things, like the ability to clamber on to ledges and cling to edges of things and stuff like that. You can't do that. Like, you can literally jump, and eventually you get a little robot friend that clutches to your back with a jetpack, and he acts like a sort of a jetpack that you can use for a couple of seconds to extend the range of your jumps. And so the thing about Monster, though, is that if he manages to eat a frog, which he is always constantly trying to eat frogs because he finds them delicious, I guess. I think that's exactly what the game says. It's like Monster finds frogs far, far more delicious than coconuts. He starts on fire and becomes engulfed in rage and will hunt down Kiko and try to like basically savage him. Like it's actually when the first time it ever happened to me anyway. It was really kind of
Or
off-putting.
Ravage.
Sorry?
Savage or Ravage?
what I was saying, I'm into some weird stuff, and I'm not saying that it doesn't involve giant gorilla rhino red men, but I'm not saying it does. No, so he actually, like, he, like, picks you up in his jaws and, like, fucking chomps down on you and, like, whips his head around like a dog with a chew toy and throws you around. But it doesn't kill you or even really hurt you or anything, but it impedes your progress and slows you down significantly. And that's sort of like the fail state of the game, I guess. There's no fail state exactly in the traditional sense, which is kind of interesting, I think. And so the core sort of story is that there's a girl who is following Kiko around, and like Kiko is following her around, and they kind of like interplay with each other. And she eventually tells Kiko that there is a magic shaman who can cure monster of his bouts of rage if they can just get to this shaman. So they kind of go on like this sort of like, I don't know, 3-4-5 hour adventure to find the shaman to cure monster of his rage. And the gameplay, I reviewed this game, and the gameplay is not super fun, but it's also not terrible. So, and I kind of mentioned it in the review, the game is really heavy. It's really deep, really, really sad. And like, at no point, I think that's the end goal of the game, is to make you feel sad. The same way, I say this also in the review, is that the way Amnesia: The Dark Descent is designed entirely to make you feel fear, like to pure, unadulterated, just paranoia and terror. I think that this game is designed in such a way as to, you know, both the story and the gameplay, which I'll get to in a second, to make you feel sad at any given point, to make you feel like hopeless and sorrowful and lost and powerless and not really sure what to do, and sort of recreate the sort of emotions that the designer, who had this father, felt when he was a child. And like you sort of, in this 4 or 5 hours, you go on the same sort of emotional like a microcosm of the emotional ride that he would have had to have dealt with as the son of this alcoholic, when with this abusive father. And so the gameplay is not fun, but it is also not like, it's not terrible. It's just kind of uninspired, I think is a good word for it. But so at first I thought that was kind of a knock against the game, and I mentioned this in the review, but I think that actually in the end it actually works toward in the game's favor, that it's not actually fun to play, because it's not like I said, frustrating or anything like that. It's just, kind of there, and it's sort of the fact that it's not engaging. The actual playing of the game is not engaging or fun. I think helps the story kind of tell what it, tell its story. Because if you were having fun playing this game, it would be antithetical to what that game is trying to make you feel. And I think that the game tries to make you feel sadness instead of trying to make you feel fun. Like Mario tries to make you feel fun. Amnesia of the Dark Descent, it tries to make you feel happy. Amnesia of the Dark Descent makes you feel scared. I think Papo and Yo make you feel sad. And the gameplay leads into that by making you feel powerless, because you can't do anything to hurt Monster or keep Monster from getting at you except just run away. And you constantly have to try and help, and you're constantly trying to fix him, because the only way to get Monster to feel, or to be normal again and not try to kill Kiko or savage him or beat the shit out of him, is to feed him rotten coconuts, which will kind of knock him out, and he'll wake up kind of confused and not really know what's going on. But I think the gameplay, that part of the gameplay, like, lends itself well to the feeling of hopelessness and powerlessness, and but at the same time kind of bleeding into the connection that you have to Monster as a father type figure, because he is what you would think of as a family member. You would imagine that, and you hear this kind of story all the time when you hear about like the relatives of alcoholics and such, is that you still constantly try to help them, try to save them, just like you're trying to save him by taking him to the shaman. And anyway, so I won't get it too much more into the story details there, and I think I'll just kind of cut it off here. But I think what I'm going to say is that I really, really enjoyed Papo and Yo. I really loved it. I think it's a very interesting thing for video games to be trying to do, to try and like tell an emotion rather than an actual plot. And I think it's
I
think it pulls it off very, very well. And I really hope that it sells well, because I would love to see more of these games of these types, or at the very least, I would love to see Minority do a new game and see what else they can do, see if this is just their one trick because of if this only works because of the backstory being connected to an
actual
event and everything. Like, I hope that's not the case. I hope that they can tell this, or they can do some more interesting things with stories that are less autobiographical. But yeah, that's kind of how I feel about Papanyo. I mean, I was crying at the end, if that says anything. I was bawling like a baby. And
the really cool thing,
I think,
about,
it's deserved. I think it was deservedly so.
I think it's neat how you said, like, the mechanics of it are kind of like representative of what the themes of it. That's kind of interesting, because it's like, you know, most games, the mechanics, you know, that's kind of all, I mean, games at their core are that. So it's kind of interesting to have something kind of show that through the mechanics. And if it's not in your way, or if it's not annoying, and it's actually kind of giving you, it's coming through that theme. That's a neat thing. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the review or not. I can't quite remember, but it was something I thought about at the time, which was that it actually uses the fact that it is a video game to tell a story at the same time. So, like, there are certain, in a video game, there are certain ideas that are sort of inbred into the very core of being a video game. So, like, if something is trying to hurt you, it is an enemy, right? And if something is trying to help you, it is an ally. And your brain sort of segments those two different things as two unique objects, two completely different things. Except Monster switches at any given point, depending on, you know, what he's consumed, between being an enemy and being an ally. And so my brain kept, like, saying, like, okay, big flaming red monster, that is bad. That is bad guy. That is enemy. That is villain. But then good monster is, like, ally. That is helpful. That is tool. That is useful. That is video game, you know, thing that can help me. But then when you think about that for a couple seconds, you think about that a little bit longer, and you realize that that is the same person or the same character or whatever, just acting in two different ways. And I think that kind of, if you think of Monster as a representation of a human being, I think it goes a little bit longer. I think there's, like, a message in there about how a person can be two completely different people, like an alcoholic. I mean, specifically an alcoholic, but, like, they're, you know, no matter what the issue with the human is, if it's some kind of bipolar disorder, or if it's some kind of other obsession, if it's drugs, if it's anger, just pure old anger issues, like, they can become a completely different person, even though they're the same person, that you know that they are the same person. And I think that is sort of why you constantly want to help this thing that is trying to kill you, is because you know that that thing can be, if you get rid of this enemy, like, if you do the thing that you do in video games to enemies, which is to destroy them, you will be rewarded with an ally, with a tool. And I think that kind of speaks to some of the psychology behind victims of abuse. And it uses the very fact that it is a video game to tell that story without actually saying any of this. I think that's incredibly terrific. I think that's a tremendous feat.
Yeah, that's it. You kind of sold me on the game. Yeah. I was thinking about, I was going to play it originally, just hearing about it originally. But yeah, I think I'll try it out definitely now.
Yeah, there's been some pretty bad reviews on it, and all the reviews are focusing on, like, saying, like, oh yeah, it's an interesting story, but the gameplay is just not great. Like, well,
yeah, yeah, that's what I've mostly seen.
I think that's kind of the point. Like, the gameplay in Amnesia is not great, but that is the point, because the gameplay in Amnesia not allowing, like, the gameplay in Amnesia: The Dark Descent is walking around, like, that is what you do in Amnesia: The Dark Descent. But the fact that that is all you can do feeds into the fear, which is what makes Amnesia: The Dark Descent a great game. And I think that is part of the fact that this takes that in a different way, rather than saying, like, hey, this is not fun, because if it was fun, it would be sending you a mixed message here. You should not be having fun.
Right.
Yeah, nobody said that mechanics have to be fun, or they have to be really entertaining to be good.
But yeah, nobody ever said a video game had to be fun to be a good video game. It's just something that we all kind of, I think it's a holdover from video games being born out of, like, being considered video games
toys,
still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sure. It's just this unwritten, sort of unspoken thing that video games should be fun. Like, you read or have a review, you know, read some really terrible reviews, and I just mean like terribly written reviews in general, and people always say, at the end of the day, video games should be about fun. Like, well, should they?
Yeah.
Like, that's one question is like, people hate that because it's pointing out an assumption that should be inherent to everything. But I kind of hate that because I realize, like, maybe a video game shouldn't be fun. Like, The Scream, you know, if a painting is not fun, you know, it's not. Or if I look at The Scream, it does not give me a sense of, you know,
beauty,
joy, or enjoyment to look at that kind of painting. It gives me different. It gives me a different response, and I think that the concept that video games can give different responses than what we just all assume that a video game should give you is something worth looking into and worth exploring and worth rewarding by, you know, purchasing Papo and Yo and experiencing it for yourself.
I think that sentiment is almost applicable to Spec Ops, which I guess you didn't play, but you probably should. Like, it's kind of almost the same argument. Mm. Gameplay doesn't need to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what I know, that's bad.
I mean, the game isn't that great, but I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting thought, interesting way to look at it, I guess.
Yeah. It's another thing that makes me just think, like, we need a different word than video, like a different phrase than video game.
Except if you say anything but video game, you
sound like an asshole. If you say, if you try to say interactive experience or something, you know, something like that.
Interactive entertainment.
It just sounds dumb. Like, fuck it. But, like, video game, like, carries with it these subconscious connotations that a game should be fun to play. And I don't think that's necessarily the truth with all video games. I'm not saying that that some video games or even most video games shouldn't be fun. I'm just saying that, like, there are other parts of the psyche worth exploring than other than the instant gratification of enjoyment, you know, like the visceral response of doing something and then having that thing make you be fun. I think there are different parts of the psyche worth exploring, and I think video games are especially potent because of the fact that it is an interactive experience. I think they are especially potent at creating a visceral response from the user, from the player, to make them experience, like, to allow them to explore different parts of their own emotions. And in this case, it's sadness. And I think that this is like this feels almost like the beginning of a new genre, the same way that survival horror was the beginning of a new genre, because it was a game that didn't focus on anything but atmosphere. Like Silent Hill is a good example of, like, a game that focuses on atmosphere, that focused on atmosphere over gameplay. And people make that argument all the time that, like, well, the shooting in Silent Hill sucks, or the combat in Silent Hill sucks because it's supposed to make you feel powerful or powerless. But then, like, so those same people turn around and say, like, Papo and Yo is not a good game because the platforming isn't fun. Well, it's not. If it was fun, then it wouldn't be doing the thing that it's supposed to be doing. I've talked way too much about this game, but I mean, I think that's just reflective of how fucking amazing I think Papo and Yo is. I gave it a 4 out of 5, not a 5 out of 5. I would have given it a 5 out of 5, but there are some bugs in the game too. So those bugs were a little bit that were kind of annoying, but I don't think it's a really game breaking or like a deal breaker. So that's Papo and Yo. Sorry about that. I know I ran a little bit long there, but I think this is something that really deserved some conversation.
You know, it's one of those things where you look at the stuff that PSN, that Sony's doing right now, especially with their indie stuff and their PSN stuff. I mean, we just talked about Sound Shapes and how really cool it is. Mutant Blobs Attack. We had Journey earlier this year, or now we have Papo and Yo, and they're consistently allowing these really art house style games to appear. You almost never see that on Xbox Live, on XBLA. If you do, it's usually in the indie game section. It's not promoted very well. But the stuff that tends to appear on PlayStation Network seems to be a little bit more aimed, and again, less at fun and more at kind of the overall experience, right? Because, like, Journey made people cry. You've heard that sentiment. You've heard now Papo and Yo. Mutant Blobs Attack is certain, and it's much more traditional, but it still has its very wonderful little quirks to it. And Sound Shapes is very different, flower and flow. of course, those games. So it's really refreshing to see almost like the you know, the college theater style of video games.
That maybe carries with it a little bit too negative of a connotation for some people, but you know what? College theater is totally a cool way to like a really apt analogy for this. Yeah.
It's like where all the cool ideas come from, and all the people that you hope to see working on the next big blockbuster are coming from these types of games, and you hope that this type of stuff can carry over onto bigger AAA games instead of just shooting monsters. Right.
Yeah,
maybe it never will.
It may never will. You're right. It may never.
I don't know, but because Journey was like the best selling PSN game of all time, wasn't it? And that was very much like going against the grain of, of traditional video game stylings. And the fact that they keep making them, to me, says that they're at least somewhat like successful. Like if they weren't successful, I mean, Sony is still a business. They would be trying to secure more things like Dust and Elysian Tail, or maybe that's a bad example because that is also kind of maybe a. I haven't played enough, played any of it, but from what I've seen, that seems to be trying some new things too. But they're not pulling in Tony Hawk Pro Skater HD, that's not the stuff that they're really putting their weight behind. They're really putting their weight behind these things that you can't get anywhere else except for PSN, which is, it sounds like a fucking marketing pitch, and maybe it kind of is, because I want more people to go and experience these things. Like Journey, is a great example. I think Papo and Yo and Journey might go down as great companion pieces together. Like to see those kind of two games played side by side pretty much speak pretty well to like what PlayStation Network downloadables are all about.
Very cool. Very cool. Tell me a little bit about just a little bit, because we're starting to run out of time here, about Darksiders 2, because that game is also getting a lot of buzz right now for kind of the opposite, being a little bit more action, fun, adventure based.
Yeah, Darksiders 2. I haven't written. I'm writing a review on that too. I've talked about it in tweets a little bit. It is the sequel to Darksiders. Obviously, in this game, you play as Death.
No way.
Instead of War. I'm sorry.
It's a sequel to Darksiders 1. What are you talking about?
yeah. Like, I don't know if you know this, Dally, but the two games are connected. Actually, it takes place in the middle of Darksiders. So, like the original Darksiders. Had like a prologue and then jumps forward like 100 years or something, or 400 years or something. This takes place in that gap in between where that game jumped forward. At least the part that I'm in so far, it might jump forward as well. I'm not sure. You play Death. So whereas Darksider, I think the most important thing to get out of the way is, and probably maybe the most important thing that needs to be said just in general about the game, maybe the only thing, is that whereas Darksiders 1 was a Zelda game, it was not an homage, it was not a send-up, it was a Zelda game. Like, it had a hook shot, it had bomb flowers, it had heart pieces, it had a Dark Link fight in it. Like, in every way it could have been Zelda except for name, it was a Zelda game. But that just happened to also have a bunch of really crazy cool ideas and stuff from other video games thrown inside of it. But, like, at its very, very heart, it was a Zelda game. Darksiders 2, on the other hand, while it still takes in a lot of influences and wears those influences on its sleeve, it feels like they're much more even-handed on how they pepper their influences together, and it feels, because of that, it feels more like its own beast. It feels like they haven't gone too heavily into any one game, and then so what you end up finding is that just like any video game. It is sort of the offspring of its influences, but it is still a unique individual in itself. Like, you could argue that Crash Bandicoot is basically a ripoff of Super Mario Brothers 3 or something like that, because they both have hub worlds and they're both jumping, but they pull in all these different concepts and become their own animals. And Darksiders 2 does that much more successfully than Darksiders 1. I don't think necessarily Darksiders 1 was trying to do that. But so this one actually doesn't pepper in as much Zelda thing as Zelda stuff as I would have thought. It's more like the combat is very Devil May Cry. It's very juggle heavy, very fast. Trying to like sort of crowd management, that sort of thing. But I think the most important two influences are it is Diablo in the sense that it is loot drop heavy and blended with Prince of Persia of all things, like really that, like that very specific type of platforming where you know wall runs and jumping off of one wall to jump onto another wall to jump off of that wall again, like the screw attack type jump. So it sort of blends like that kind of stuff, those two kind of core gameplay mechanics, like the platforming of Prince of Persia and the combat of Devil May Cry and the, I suppose there's more than two, and the loot drop of Diablo, and then puts it in an open world Skyrim type environment with fast travel and everything. And it's also really fucking fun. It's in every way, in my opinion, it is more fun to play than the original Darksiders. The environments are more open. The combat feels a lot nicer. The characters feel a lot more interesting, I think. Like, I think the original Darksiders 1 was well written, but I thought it felt a little plain at points because I thought War felt, he didn't feel like a Kratos type space marine or anything like that, but I felt I was a little bland. But Death, on the other hand, is like fucking got this snide motherfucker just like constantly sneering through his mask at everybody he encounters, constantly dropping one-liners about how much he fucking hates everybody, but just like always being like doing it in the most like douchebaggy way, but also kind of going but the way that the story is going, it seems like he's kind of maybe finding some humility in that too. I don't know. He seems to be going through some interesting stuff. He seems like this is going to sound really corny, but I think that the mask he wears may also be metaphorical at the same time. I think that his sort of snide, sniggery attitude is maybe to hide some real emotions that he has that they're kind of peppering throughout the game. And I think it's much better written than the first game and much more interesting from that perspective as well. But I'm absolutely loving it. It may be, thus far, it's certainly in the running for my top 10 games of the year, for Game of the Year nominations at the end of 2012 here. It just the first, like, opening prologue level tutorial thing just fucking blew me away, and it really hasn't stopped being that interesting. I don't know how to describe it without giving away too much more, but yeah, you should definitely go play it. It stands on its own pretty well too. You probably want to play Darksiders 1 to get a lot of the references. A couple of characters return, nobody too major thus far in my playthrough. Like the shopkeeper from the first game shows up again, Volgrim. But yeah, I even if you haven't played the first Darksiders, I would recommend going back and playing the first Darksiders, but go and play Darksiders 2 if you absolutely have to pick one or the other. Go play Darksiders 2 because it is really good, and like kudos to Vigil. I hope this game does well, because if it does, this is the game that this is the game we deserve from THQ to save THQ right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Save THQ by Darksiders 2.
Hopefully. It sounds like it's a good game, though. So
yeah, and I'm kind of trying to keep it shorter because it's a massive fucking game as well. There's a ton of stuff going on. There's like horde mode. There's side quests. It's got like the Mass Effect dialogue system. There's all kinds of stuff going on. So
but I didn't realize it had a dialogue system.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's fucking crazy.
It sounds like the game that Vigil wanted to make when they were doing Darksiders, and they just kind of did it, which is cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, the original Darksiders was, if you listen to Joe Mad talk about it, it was like, it was originally going to have loot drop, but they took that out at the last second. But the original Darksiders was going to be four-player co-op, which if you play the first Darksiders, I mean, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler to say, the ending of the first Darksiders kind of implied that Darksiders 2 would be a four-player co-op game. But that's not what they kind of that's not what they ended up the direction they ended up going. And I also really like this concept of making a sequel to a game that has like that shares some core core mechanics and some core concepts with the original, but is also like shockingly different. Like it feels like I was not expecting it to be as different as it was. Like with this heavy emphasis on Prince of Persia style platforming, and the game, even the combat feels a little different. The first game was basically God of War. The second game is more Devil May Cry. You know, it's more juggle heavy. It's a lot more crowd management rather than the heavily combo-based stuff of the first game. And the Diablo-type stuff, you know, goes a long way to making it feel a lot different, too. And just the fact that it's an open-world game as opposed to, like, the kind of hub world that the first game had, the Zelda-style, like, go to Dungeon A, go to Dungeon X. This one has, like, side dungeons that don't have anything in them except for interesting loot and stuff for you to find, a la Skyrim kind of style. And it's really interesting, and it feels good, and yeah. Yeah, I don't know how many ways I can say, hey, you should go play this game. It's crazy, and it's really good. Like, good on Vigil. Good on all those guys. And I know some people kind of have an issue with the Darksiders art style, or at least some people talk about how some people have an issue with the Darksiders art style. But I really like Joe Mad's look, the to death and to just the worlds in general. And it actually kind of has a very unique look to it, even compared to the original Darksiders. It looks pretty unique as well, which is interesting. It's just cool to see a sequel that doesn't just copy the first game again. It kind of reminds me of Super Mario Brothers 2 in a respect, just like making this almost completely different game that has some of the same concepts but does so many things so out there and different from the first one. Like it feels like the kind of game that doesn't get made anymore, and that's worth something too, I think.
It's always good to hear about, you know, that kind of thing, and working on a sequel where it's more than just, you know, more than just a rehash of the first game.
I mean, it says Darksiders 2 on the box, but it would almost, I wouldn't, like, if they had rebranded this as, like, Darksiders Rising, you know, Darksiders Rising Revengeance, it would have felt more apropos, I think, to have, like, said this was a spinoff, except that at the same time, it takes that first story of the first game and expands on it. So it's like it's still telling that same story and still set in that same kind of timeline. They've just said, like, we're just not going to remake the first game. How about that? You know? And, like, that's so cool. It's such a ballsy move, too, especially in the position that THQ and everybody is in.
Yeah.
But it is
yeah.
so good that, like, I just really want to see it succeed.
Yeah, good on THQ and Vigil for pumping that one out. I mean, it from all the stuff we've played this last few weeks, it sounds like there's definitely some good games to be had here at the tail end of summer.
Yeah, they're coming out. They're finally starting to emerge from the darkness. They're coming out of the cube.
They're coming from the dark side.
From the dark side of the cube.
Yeah, but it's not all good news though. There've been some layoffs.
Oh no.
Yeah, Steven, can you tell us a little bit about the layoffs?
Studio Liverpool, creators of the Wipeout franchise, my favorite racing franchise, has been shut down by Sony.
See, it's because I didn't like Wipeout 2048, wasn't it?
That's exactly why it is. Because you.
Yep,
we're done.
yeah, it's. I mean, it's sad news. There was about 100 employees working there. They've been shut down. It seems like. Like, it's mostly just the kind of the development. So Studio Liverpool is kind of like a piece of what was affected by this. It's like they're shutting down like their UK operations, I think is like the official term. But a lot of their stuff that's still UK based, like localization teams and some sort of like publishing teams or some stuff like that is being left behind as well. But it's just the main development teams that were the creators of Wipeout 2048. They were originally Psygnosis, back in the day when they were founded. They published the original Lemmings. If you don't like Wipeout, like here's something else that these guys are behind. They created Colony Wars on the PlayStation 1, which I just bought today. As a kind of send off to them, I guess, because the only reason I bought it for $3, but I thought it was like a good send off to buy one of their original games. It's a sad thing. This year 2012 has not been good for developers. Like, it seems like they're closing down left and right. Like, every week we read about another development studio that gets shut down, and Studio Liverpool was such a great team. I don't think they'd ever put out a bad game. And to see them go is really disheartening. Because it's not like they put out any flops. It's not like they put out any terrible games. It's not like they put out anything that wasn't a good seller. I mean, they put out Wipeout 2048, which was a decent seller for Vita standards. Like they didn't do anything wrong, and yet they still got shut down. Partially, I think it's because I think that what they did wrong, I guess, is existing in the UK because it's really expensive to make games in the UK. It's bad news. I guess some like details leaked out later on to Eurogamer that they were working on a next generation Wipeout game Orbis or PlayStation 4 that would have been, I can't remember the exact terminology used, but it was like remarkably different, I think was maybe the quote from what they had done in the past. And they were also working on a what was described as a Splinter Cell style of game that used LA Noir style facial motion capture. So as the weeks drag on, we'll either see footage of that sort of stuff or some assets for that sort of stuff, or we won't. If we do start seeing stuff like that, it probably means that it's canceled. But if we don't start seeing stuff like that from the canceled Wipeout PlayStation 4 product or whatever, it probably means it's been shuffled around to another studio somewhere else.
Sony will probably want to hold on to it.
Yeah, this is not the end of the Wipeout franchise for those who might be worried about that. There's been a Wipeout game on literally every Sony platform since the PlayStation 1. Yeah, every single one, and there was even one on Nintendo 64. So I bet you that franchise is not going anywhere. Wipeout HD did really, really well for them, and they just released DLC just not a week or two ago for Wipeout 2048, which was like all of the levels from Wipeout 20 or from Wipeout HD and from the Wipeout HD DLC all came to Wipeout 2048 for free if you owned them on PS3, and you could play all those levels and all those tracks and all the events and things. And so I will bet you this is not the last we will see of that, but the Splinter Cell thing seems a little bit more ambiguous. So yeah, that's the end of Studio Liverpool. It's really sad to see them go.
Yeah, it's a lot of times we tend to forget that the video game industry is a business, and that if certain things aren't producing or money's not coming in the way it should be, then we get studio closures, we get shifts, we get changes, and it's just a way of life now. I think
they're an interesting example of like you don't even have to do anything wrong. Like I said,
The
fact that they exist. I think this is probably to do with the fact that they existed in the UK, which is where game development is very difficult to get through, which is why you don't see a lot of UK game developers. It's just shitty. to be these 100 employees or whatever to just work on all this stuff and do well at their jobs and make great games and those great games sell pretty well.
Sure.
See it all just kind of fall apart from under them just because they were there in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's real crap.
Yeah. Hope that they get. Get their careers, keep the careers going, get the job somewhere, working on something. I'm sure they will. They're all the super talented staff over there. Again, even though I wasn't a huge fan of 2048, I know a lot of people that were, including Steven. So,
yeah, Jesse Gregory as well was pretty upset to see them go. I'm sure. We got some Wipeout fans over here at SideQuesting.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
Jesse Gregory is not SideQuesting, but he is. He's part of the family.
He's part of our family. If you want to be a part of our family, you can please hop onto iTunes, rate us. Be honest, be fair. We do our best to bring you an awesome show each week, and we hope that they continue to get better. So hopefully that those scores end up going up. Hint, hint,
yeah.
Nudge, nudge.
But we won't try to influence you one way or the other.
Not at all. No, not at all.
At all.
Not
no.
at all. But no. what you could do is you can email
us. We have candy.
Yeah, we have candy.
We won't try to influence you.
We have drugs.
That was supposed to be no. Remember what I said about the FCC? They're listening. They know about my.
Sorry about that.
They can hear about the drugs now.
We have tabs of acid that we're giving out to everybody who gives.
No,
us
that's
five
worse.
Stars.
You're going into specifics.
If you give us 5 stars, we'll give you tabs of acid and ecstasy.
All
ecstasy
right.
comes
that's
in tabs.
I'm
right?
being arrested. I'm being deported back to Norway.
Being deported back to Norway. You can also email us with your comments, questions, and any other ideas you have to podcast@sidequesting.com, where we will take a look at what you got to say. We'll even read some of our best, some of the best questions and comments on the air. Don't forget to join our book club. Currently, we're reading The Hollow City by Dan Wells. I'm about 12 chapters in. I think we're coming up on the 20th chapter kind of assessment here pretty soon. So, yeah, pick it up if you get a chance. It's available on iTunes if you want to do the whole iBooks thing, or you can go to your local Barnes & Noble, pick it up, Kindle. It's all over the place. But I'm really enjoying it. And Dan Wells has actually been really cool and retweeting and mentioning it to his followers and his readers and stuff. So getting good support from him. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. You can always find me at Coolrats, KEWLRATS. You can find Tyler at
Tyler Culp, TYLERCOLP.
And Steven at
Steven Strom, STEVENSTROM.
STEVENSTROM. That's like the Mickey Mouse Club. I like that.
I wonder if you what would happen if you typed my name into a phone. My first name. And then the last letter of my first letter of my last name, I guess.
We'll give it a shot. We'll have to try it. You can follow the side questing team.
It wouldn't be an episode of the side quest if I didn't talk over Dally at some point.
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't be a side quest episode. No, you can follow us on Twitter at side questing, and hear all of our breaking news and cool features and all that fun stuff. And Tyler's got some cool features brewing. Steven's got some stuff brewing. Yep. Not features.
Your Papa Strum is about to drop so many reviews on you. You know you've been good and you deserve it.
You're going to drop so many deuces all over the place. Just going to make it.
All of those reviews have 2 out of 5 stars. So, deuces.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that kind of deuce. Yeah.
No, that's not true.
No, there's a lot of cool features coming up. Tyler, have a good time over at PAX.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Seems like it's gonna be
the first
really
time
cool
going as
here.
Press.
Oh, so. Awesome!
Oh, go
all those appointments.
Yeah, Steven.
Have fun, Tyler. It's so PAX is fucking great.
Yeah, yes. PAX is always good.
Yeah, but definitely being media helps a little bit because you can get. It's not so much access; it's just being able to ask the questions that they don't necessarily answer. To
security kind of just like leaves you alone a little bit more too. There's like, oh, okay, that guy's got a yellow pass. That means like he can do stuff that I'm not allowed to know about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is if you're trying to kill a man in the games industry, like if you can get a press badge, I'm not naming any names or nothing like that. But I'm just saying that. We know some guys who can get some stuff done, like who provide a specific service at a specific fee, you know, and like we can hook you up.
They're located in Narnia.
Mm-hmm. fun fact, every behind closed door demo, actually, the curtain that they put over those doors, is actually a portal to Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
where BioShock Infinite is right now. It's hanging out with Prey 2.
And Grand Theft Auto 5 and Last Guardian.
Well, they're both frozen in carbonite. The White Queen did a team up with Darth Vader, and she has frozen both of those games in time. It's a really sad thing. We need to go find them and stop them.
That's why they call
Tyler,
BioShock Infinite.
So Tyler, that's your assignment at PAX this year. As your editor, I'm telling you to do that. Go fix that for us.
No, Tyler is also an editor as well.
Steven. Well, while you're at it, can you talk to Atlas and tell them to release the PSP remake of Persona 2 Eternal Punishment in North America?
Yeah, I'll write that down.
Okay. Get a tattoo of it. Otherwise, you'll forget. I know.
Get a tattoo.
Yeah, and pretty bad.
His back is just a big black splotch now from all the memos I've had him write down.
They're all the same question.
They're all the same question over and over again. I don't want to go any further with his back being splotched.
Right.
So I'm going to end this podcast.
I'm just saying that Tyler is really easy to pick out in a crowd because he's got a giant floating skull that telling insults to everybody around him. So,
and it all wraps back to the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, that's called a callback, kids.
On that note, we're done. We're done for the day, guys. Thank you very much, Tyler, for joining us this week. You're always welcome back on the show. It's been great having you on. Steven, as usual, awesome. Thanks for talking over me at every opportunity. It was really fantastic.
Okay, that's great, Dally. I'm really excited that you're excited about that.
Cool things going on at the site, and we get no. I want to thank myself for staying awake after being jet lagged for like 4 days, going on like 3 days of jet lag. Oh, this is the worst, guys. Don't. Ugh. But I'm surviving. Thank you for asking, nobody. And we will see you guys in the next episode of the Side Quest. Again, sidequesting.com is where you can find us. Peace out. Peace. Peace. Steven, say bye. Do your thing.
See ya.
You're just supposed to say Steven. Like, God, this is why this show has gone down so much in quality since Eric left.
Steven?
Because of this specifically, and only this. In a fever at the castle.